Hi, this is the Venus Project podcast with Hanna Salti and me, Lili Rutai. In this podcast, we talk to interesting women about topics interesting not only to women, usually in Hungarian. But this week's guest deserves for us to try something new. Sophia Smith-Gaylor is an author and journalist. Her book, Losing It, or Mielőtt Elveszíted, is available both in English and Hungarian. In this episode, we talk to her about social media, journalism, the intersection of two and the dangers of both, as well as sexual education that she covers extensively in her book. Well, hi, Sophia, and thank you for being our first ever English language guest. First of all, can you tell me a bit about your journalism career, which has been rather unorthodox? What has led you up to writing your book, Losing It?
Yeah, so first of all, I was a journalist at the BBC. That's where I began my career. And I was a video journalist in the faith and ethics part of the BBC at the time that I came up with my book, Losing It. I have been really interested for a very long time about how not only our knowledge bases, but our cultural backgrounds may influence our approach to sex, whether it's our own sexual lives, our own sexual health, or the judgment that we have over the way that other people live. So I always had a really firm grounding in that, on top of seeing what was out there in terms of statistics and data in this space. I'd begun, my first proper job at the BBC was in a more sort of sciencey space. So I always felt really motivated by looking at what the research and the data is telling us about different places. And then I combine that with my expertise in looking at culture and investigating culture. And it's really clear if you look at the UK context, and if you look at the context of pretty much every country around the globe, that sex education is not at the standard it needs to be to help the local population deal with all of the challenges that they are facing. And what's worse is that because of this lack of education, so much pseudoscience around sex proliferates, so many pieces of myths and disinformation around sex are present on and offline, and they're influencing our health, our happiness, and our human rights. So that's how it emerged from the sort of job that I was doing at the time. And then as the book came out, I had left the BBC and I was a news reporter at Vice News. And that was a far more newsy job. You know, I was reporting on things every day. I was expected to bring in exclusive news reporting. And that's where my book, Losing It, has had some of its legacy. I've been able to keep holding power to account over issues regarding sexual and reproductive health. So, for example, after Losing It came out and I got, you know, really mad about how little the British government seems to care about sex ed, I was able to expose that they had lied about the amount of money they were going to give to train teachers to deliver sex ed. So in my journalism, that's what I try and do. I try and cover the culture and the science part of a story. And then ultimately, at the end of it, you've got to hold power to account. If there is wrongdoing or something is wrong, who is going to fix it?
You mentioned human rights, and that's the main reason we are talking to you right now. In Hungary, books involving LGBTQ propaganda are being propaganda, I mean, in
their language,
in propaganda,
yeah.
Sense, yes, in propaganda language, are being censored, such as covered in plastic, in bookstores, in like actual plastic. Are you afraid that could happen to your book, Losing It, too?
If it did, I would kick up a fuss, obviously. It's interesting what books manage to sort of slip past the radar and which don't. It's obviously something that shouldn't be happening in any country around the world, that the censoring of information regarding our sexual and reproductive health and rights and access to justice, you know, that whole space in which sexual well-being covers ultimately, which is part of our general well-being, you can't ban books. And then on top of that, what perhaps the government hasn't considered is what we often call, certainly in English, the Streisand effect. If you try and hide something, or if you try and get people to not talk about something, sometimes it makes them even more likely to want to do it. You know, books often do well when they get banned. So I don't think they've thought very hard about that either. And hopefully putting some plastic over a book isn't going to stop people from buying it. That's the real concern here. It's the government can do one thing, but it's whether they're able to develop and build enough stigma so that it actually stops people buying this stuff. That for me is the worry. It's really silly of them to do in the first place, but the worry for me is if this silly policy actually makes a real impact.
This policy, or the broader context of this policy, has also included banning or restricting sexual education in Hungarian schools. Now, I know that the UK's sexual education is imperfect, to say the least, and that is the same in most of the countries at this given moment. Do you think that your book will reach those who are in dire need of this kind of sexual education? Or do you think that students or teenagers who are particularly interested in this topic and keen on learning about it will still turn to the internet?
Importantly, my book isn't for teenagers. You know, I wrote it for an adult audience and predominantly for people who feel like their sex education failed them. And the book is reassurance that they are right to feel that way, and that action can be made. So my hope is that people who do read my book will almost become advocates in their own lives, for not only their own sexual health, but for the sexual health of those around them, as in their friends, their family, if they have children or go on to have children at some point, them as well. To try and ensure that we start building out this better cultural environment in which we understand that sex is an important part of our health and well-being as we become, you know, healthy adults, and how do we make sure that young people are best prepared for that world in the current environment that we live in. The reason that I tackle pseudoscience and health misinformation so hard is because the internet is not wholly responsible for its spread, but it's the biggest weapon. It's the biggest tool right now that people who want to spread these lies can use to make people believe in them. So that's what I hope the book can achieve.
I think as journalists, we ask ourselves this a lot with Lily as well. Do you think books, articles like yours, or any kind of media representation can really make a change? Or is really able to destroy such myths and shape society's thinking?
Well, I wouldn't have written it if I didn't think it could make a difference.
What sort of difference are you hoping to achieve? If you could expand a bit on that.
That politicians take sex education more seriously, that parents who perhaps believed in some of the misinformation that's really commonly spread, and I don't blame parents for believing this, but if they think that if they believe the common myth that sex ed is going to sexualize their kids, no, it's going to protect them. The hope is that more people get access to robust, inclusive, comprehensive sex education, whether that's in a classroom or whether that's online or whether that's talking to their friends and family.
Have you received any feedback on the kind of changes? Have you been receiving messages from parents or such? Have you had any evidence of this working?
I've had a lot of messages from people at school, even though it wasn't written for people of a young age group. I have heard from some sort of later teens talking about how they've asked to get the book included in their library, included in some of the sex ed they deliver. The book is now recommended reading from the International Planned Parenthood Federation. You can't get a higher accolade for a book about sex than from Planned Parenthood. So that's fantastic. I was asked to speak about the book at the World Health Organization's annual summit in Berlin, where tackling sex misinformation was placed front and center in a conversation around fighting health misinformation. And I have heard from parents and teachers. Teachers have asked me to come and talk about my book, And in many cases, they've asked me to talk about specific chapters in the book, which really tells me that certain areas really resonated. So there are some areas that I've seen teachers introduce in some ways, and some teachers take on another one, because very astutely, they've taken the chapters that they feel in their school context is what where more help is needed, and where they often, you know, they don't have the resources themselves. So it's been wonderful. And then across British press, when the book came out, one of our one of the best sex historians that we have in the UK said she wished she had the book growing up. And you can't ask again for sort of a better recommendation than that. That was really empowering for me.
So back to Hungary for another question. We were wondering if censorship will make the book even more popular here in Hungary, which can happen. I think it already happened. Do you think this censorship, this bookstore censorship, could really affect the LGBTQ community members and sexual education here?
As I said earlier, the censorship will be harmful if it creates stigma around consuming this content or sharing it. That's where the problem lies. It's not in the single act of censoring alone, it's the aftermath. So if in reality people are still able to access these books and access this content, then the censorship isn't really censorship. It's whether it causes enough stigma to block those entries into information access, and that will be a problem.
One place that no government can censor or control, at least not in the West, is the internet, which is a big part of your reporting, both for the book and for your articles. I really wanted to talk to you as a journalist as well about this new wave of reporting where you include a lot of information or sources, both from TikTok, Reddit, or other sites that would perhaps not come natural to more mature journalists. What is the feedback to that specific part of your reporting and your book, sourcing so much from the internet, which is this kind of obscure and obviously very deep space?
It's a big part of how I get my case studies, because I'm often reporting on areas of our intimate health and well-being where you're not necessarily going to find people having posted about it in a very open space. So a lot of my reporting often involves not necessarily going into private spaces online, but going into communities that I can access. You know, they're in the public domain, but they might be quite hard to get to. The only people who are really in them are those who are very invested in these niche topics. And I've been able to then approach people that I've been able to find in communities like that and speak to them. And that would be harder to do if you had not so much digital literacy, but certainly in the journalism reporting space, there are lots of reporters who do this and have been doing it for years.
Now, obviously, I mean, open source intelligence is on the rise, and we see it both in news journalism as well as lifestyle journalism or health journalism. How about in your journalism career? Your work on TikTok has been phenomenal as well, and you have a massive following. How did other journalists and perhaps these outlets that you work for take your online fame and your social media literacy?
So I was a video journalist at the BBC. The stories that I would go on to do for them about TikTok, I did all in my, you know, my spare time. I was not remunerated for them. And I was also told to not TikTok while I was there. That in the early days, you had a lot of people in the journalism industry condescend around the app and that it wasn't a place to do news. And then a couple of years later, I won the British Journalism Award for my use of TikTok in the innovation category, because there was one thing I was doing that a couple of us were doing in the UK. And there was another thing I was doing where I was the first in the UK, and I still remain one of the only people in the world doing it. So the first thing is publishing stories or publishing the work that you've done on TikTok. This was something that loads of people weren't doing. They still aren't. But because it takes a little bit of like video editing know-how and time. I got big on TikTok when the pandemic began, really. I'd already been accruing a bit of a following, but the minute the pandemic started, I had all this extra time, and I used that extra time to make a ton of TikToks all the time. A couple of us were trying it out as a publishing platform. What I wanted to do is really build a community around my reporting and find stories on there. And the way I've news gathered on there is I have I've come to the app every day to try and generate a conversation and relationships of trust with my followers. And if I keep making content, I found that I will get tips over my email or DMs from people who have found me on TikTok and they know my reporting. But it's also been making content where I say, I'm looking to speak to this person, or if this has happened to you, tell me about it. And that, ultimately, that's what I've won recognition for in the UK. It's using TikTok not only as a publishing tool, but as a news gathering tool as well. It's been really, really important for the investigations that I've done. It's not necessarily important for every investigation you do as a journalist, but it's a really easy tool to use for certain kinds of storytelling. And in health reporting, I think it's invaluable.
I find it really interesting. I'm a journalist in Hungary, and media outlets here are getting more accepting towards reporting about TikTok or TikTok in general, not Reddit. I think it's not an accepted thing here. And we just made our TikTok account a few months ago. So I think there is a difference between Hungary and, let's say, the UK.
Doesn't surprise me, yeah. Doesn't surprise me. I've heard that from a lot of people.
But equally, you are, I think, sorry, Hannah, for grabbing the mic. Well, as well as journalism can be a hostile environment towards the internet can be a hostile environment towards women. According to a survey by Women in Journalism, 75% of female journalists said that they had experienced a threat or a challenge to their safety online or in person during or because of their work. A quarter of these participants said that they had experienced some kind of sexual harassment or sexual violence in regards to their jobs. How do you feel online, being a woman who's so vocal about sex and sexual topics, and your journalism as well?
I can never really think of a good answer to this, because the truth is, I'm used to it. The truth is, I have so dissociated from it that I can't say it makes a huge impact on me anymore. It did in the earlier days of TikTok, when I was for the first time getting used to the feeling of not being a public figure, but being someone that more than the people I knew about, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And do you consider yourself a public figure now? Just out of interest.
No, because I don't know, maybe I'm still like informed by trad media perspectives, but I think, you know, I'm a bit internet famous. I'm not IRL famous, I don't think. And I think internet fame is a different kettle of fish to having, yeah, traditional media platform you, which I've never really had. The biggest change as well is that I was basically able to find a place for myself in the journalism industry, in a job that I wanted, which was a reporting job, in which I was, you know, candidly able to earn more money and able to be able to make decisions like, wow, now I can afford to live somewhere safer. Wow, now I can afford to do this and that. So I really had to take my own safety into my own hands and make some decisions about where was I going to be given the resources to be safe and feel safer. And definitely Advice News, they had a really good security team. So during my reporting, I always felt very, very highly protected. And yeah, now perhaps because a few years have gone by and I'm that bit more used to it, I've had the episodes where I've been really heavily targeted for a day or a few days. And when it's been nameless harassment, it's not nice, but I now have the tools to make it as sort of least life affecting as I can. And then also, in the last year, a lot of the targeting has come from the groups I've investigated. And they wouldn't be targeting me if they weren't afraid that I'd found something true. So a lot of the time when people post videos or comments about me and my reporting, and it's from anti-abortion groups, for example, that's immensely motivating for me to keep investigating them. You know, and maybe, I don't know if that's the healthiest outlook to have, but when I see stuff like that, I just think, I've got you. I've got you. I've wound you up because I'm onto something. Thanks for the reminder. I'm going to check you out tomorrow.
I think it's the best approach to have. I mean, we really try to do the same here. And I find it really hard that you just have to figure out all by yourself, because like online harassment is now, it's just becoming a thing. There are no examples on how to solve these issues.
And for me, the resources and the resilience that I've built to deal with all of this have largely come from work I've done on myself in my own time, and friendships that I've worked hard to maintain. And it's great when a job can also offer you, you know, really good resources and protection. But actually, a lot of making it through day by day is self-work, and looking at who is in your life to support you. Do you have the right people in your life?
And if you're talking about online, do you have any tips or just practices to share, as in what to post, how to protect your address, identity, parts of your personal life?
So I'm actually really liking Instagram at the minute, because Instagram has given me the feature to only allow comments from people who follow me. That straight away minimizes the sort of negative sentiment comments that I have so much of. And I get a lot of negative comments when people are very angry, not at me, but angry at the news story that I have covered, which they have a huge opinion on. And because I make a lot of content now, especially around language, which has always been, I've always made loads of TikToks about languages. Languages have been a really important part of my journalism. You know, it's the first thing I studied way before I dreamed of becoming a journalist. I was a linguist first. And there are people who, when you make content about other people, other languages, other cultures, if they don't like people from other cultures or people speaking other languages, they get very angry about it. And there's no place or tolerance for racism on my page. So this feature has become a very quick way for me to get rid of a lot of those people. There is the limits feature in Instagram as well that would allow me, if I was being heavily targeted one day by a particular group, which has happened on Instagram before when I was making content about feminism, that's helped me kind of get through that day as well. And it helps you limit your profile till these people get bored and move on. So, yeah, that's all been really useful. And I do just, if I get a comment that's negative about my appearance or negative about something that's personal to me, it's not a criticism on the sort of news story or the information that I'm covering, I have a immediate delete and block policy. There's no patience for me. I don't need to give anyone patience if they're being rude. Delete and block. And yeah, like, isn't it sad that that's been their contribution to the internet that day? But that's their problem, not mine. So delete and move on.
What do you think could be done to make reporting and online journalism safer? So are there any good examples at one of the places or media outlets you've been working at on how to make online journalism in general safer for women journalists?
I had really good digital security training at Vice that was not specific to my gender.
And how about other practices? I find that in the UK media, for example, having groups like Women in Journalism helps to discuss these topics more, which also contributes to the well-being of female journalists and tackling harassment online or so.
No one else in my industry has my platform that I have, in terms of they're an independent content creator that makes the quantity of videos that I make every week that are not connected to their staff journalism role. There's no one else doing that. So I have no blueprint. I have no support network. I have had to create it myself. This year I had a fellowship with Brown University where I've built a resource that schools can implement to help give confidence and vocabulary to children over 14 about the world of content creation and how they can make a positive social change with vertical video. So I have done that, but ultimately it's not my responsibility to protect people online. No one's felt it's their responsibility to ever protect me. I hopefully make an impact in not letting it get me down and showing that, hey, you've got to, if I don't turn up here every day for myself and I let negative comments get me down, I can't let that happen. And I'm not going to, I wouldn't want people to feel like, oh, wow, that happened to Sophia. Now she's not making videos. No, I'm going to turn up. I'm going to turn up for you. But yeah, it's the labor shouldn't be on me to protect other people. In fact, I didn't need to do the Brown Fellowship. It was so much work on top of my day job and was really tough. But I really felt like, hey, this is a way I can turn some of what I've learned into something positive, and hopefully help if someone wants to implement it, you know, they can use an educational resource that can help encourage other people to make the kind of content that I do and the kind of content that the people I admire make. You know, they turn up every day to make a positive social change with a reel or a YouTube short or a TikTok. That's the most I can do.
Maybe the best thing you can do is to be there and do what you do. How do you think your book will age?
No idea. I pessimistically think that any country is going to be slow to reform their sex education. So the information in my book's probably going to remain relevant for quite some time. But in an ideal world, my book would age very quickly because change would be implemented and misinformation would be relegated to the past. You know, these myths that are already archaic, for example, around virginity, we wouldn't even say the word virgin or virginity anymore. And I'm not confident that's going to happen. I think a lot more people in positions of power need to take this information and act on it.
Well, I think that was a gorgeous final answer. Thank you so much, Sophia, for joining us in this episode and talking to us about your book, which is available both in English and Hungarian bookshops. It's called Losing It or Mielőtt Elveszíted.
Thank you so much. And I really hope that, I'm really proud and happy that it got a Hungarian translation. So whether you read it in English or Hungarian, I really hope the book does for you what writing it did for me, which is give me some of my life back. It really helped me process my own sexual biography and realize that, hey, some of the things that happened weren't down to me or things that I did. You know, we live in a very victim-blaming kind of world and I'd self-projected that. And instead, society and the systems of power in the society that we live in make these things happen. And if we become advocates in our personal lives for positive sexual and reproductive health, education, rights, justice, we can put an end to it.
Let's hope for this. This was the Venus Project podcast with Hanna Scholti and me, Lili Rutai. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media to get more Hungarian and English episodes.